IVM. Hello, welcome and khushamadeed. You're listening to The Note with me, Mahrukh Inayat. This, in fact, happens to be the last episode of The Note for 2020. What a year it's been. I wanted to end the year by talking about the one issue that's closest to my heart, the politics of Jammu and Kashmir. In the recent week or so, you would have seen pictures of long lines of people casting their votes for what are called the District Development Council elections that were held in Jammu and Kashmir. Historic, as they were called by many, because they were held for the very first time. But to understand what do these elections mean for the region, does it mean that people have forgotten the abrogation of Article 370? What does it mean for the political parties of the Union Territory of Jammu and Kashmir? I have one of India's leading thinkers, writers of international affairs, and somebody who understands the politics of the region better than most, Mr. Amitabh Mattu. Mr. Mattu, thank you so much for joining us on The Note. Let me get straight on to the questions. Mr. Mattu, my first question is, why are these District Development Council elections historic?
I think, Mahrukh, first of all, it's a great pleasure and honor to be on your program, and I wish it great success. But I think the reason why so much importance and so much attention is being paid to these polls is for the following reasons. One, these are the first polls conducted after the decision to abrogate Article 370 and Article 35A by the Parliament. So there were lots of expectations, attention paid on how the Kashmiri or people of Jammu and Kashmir would react to the polls. The second was that in some ways this is a new experiment to have district development councils itself. Nowhere in the rest of the country do you have the whole state being represented by such bodies with such authority. And it's not really based on population. It's almost like a Senate election. Every district has exactly the same number of representatives, which is 14 and 20 districts. That makes us 280. Third, I think the BJP upped the ante during the elections by having a large presence of union ministers there. So for all sorts of reasons, I think historic may be perhaps too loaded a term, but certainly very significant.
Okay. You know, one of the things that I noticed was, Mr. Mattu, that data seems to suggest that the polling percentage, especially in areas like, you know, Avantipura, even Srinagar, traditionally known to shun the electoral process, at least in the last Lok Sabha elections, we saw that the polling percentage was very low. This time, we see that it has increased substantially. What do you attribute to that?
I think, first of all, what you must attribute to it is the resilience of the people of Jammu and Kashmir. Ultimately, I think at the core of their essence is a great belief and faith in democracy. More importantly, when there aren't larger issues at stake, but issues like sadak, bijli, pani, which is electricity, roads, water, bread and butter issues, which is what these councils will actually do. They are not going to be about resolving larger political issues of Jammu and Kashmir. They are about deliverance on the ground. So I think this is surprising to me as well, that there wasn't any sense of boycott. There was a feeling that you need to participate. Of course, cynical you could be, that in the valley itself, there was a coming together of the Gupkar alliance and people coming out to vote to keep the BJP out. While in Jammu or parts of the Jammu region, there was a swing for the Modi wave, which still exists in Jammu. So all sorts of explanations, but certainly intriguing and interesting how there were a large section, about over 30% Jammu in the valley, over 30% coming out and voting is not a small thing, given that in the past, as you said, in South Kashmir, places like Avantipur, Shopian, Pulwama, you had single-digit voting. If that, right. And Jammu, you have over 60% voting, which itself is surprising.
You know, I take your point on the one hand, Mr. Mattu. And then there are, you know, articles like a recent one that was published in the New York Times that seems to suggest that people in the valley are still suppressed. And this democratic exercise, even though we've seen a certain voting percentage, doesn't really amount to much. Now, are they revealing, are pieces like these revealing another dimension to the ground reality? Or is it that their understanding, the understanding of the journalists who write these pieces, is their understanding limited? What would you say?
I think Jammu and Kashmir is deeply political. It's embedded in the psyche of each one of citizens, residents of Jammu and Kashmir, and alas, also in terms of people who report on Jammu and Kashmir. So you always can focus on either the silver lining, where there are dark clouds, and undoubtedly, or you can only focus on the dark clouds. You and I belong to Jammu and Kashmir, so we can appreciate that both these narratives coexist in
right.
The glass can be half full or half empty. It depends on the way you look at it. So on the one hand, people see, oh, there is a silver lining. Maybe we can acquire some political space, some agency through this. On the other hand, oh, this is an exercise in futility. If you look at the social media, there was this elderly gentleman coming out of a polling booth saying elections haven't mattered in Kashmir. They won't matter. I just went in, did the ritual and came out. And others who believe that each vote actually counts, that you can make a difference. So the reality, as always, is somewhere in between, that these district development councils can be an instrument of change. You had an experiment similar in Ladakh, where the Hill Development Council actually was able to exercise great agency, carve out space for itself, especially when you focus on deliverance, on of basic services on the ground. But if you assume that these, the council will suddenly acquire the shape, form, or have the agency to resolve larger political issues, then of course it's doomed to fail.
But I'm always curious, how do you explain this, since you're also a fellow Kashmiri, how do you explain this dichotomy to people outside Jammu and Kashmir? You know, a lot of people ask me this question, that on the one hand, we see people coming out and vote, and on the other, they won't think twice before shouting a slogan of Azadi. How would you explain this dichotomy to people outside the valley, or how do you do that? I'm very curious.
I think, one, of course, there is, it's not unique. It's not sui generis to Jammu and Kashmir. In any conflict anywhere in the world, these narratives exist. On the one hand, you will have people who will be seen as being collaborators. And on the other hand, there will be those who will keep on exercising their absolutist views in terms of their writing, in terms of the slogans, and sometimes the same person does it. But that's part of our human character, that you will try and use every opportunity available for you to make a difference. And yet, there is this larger sense of political grievance, a sense of great victimhood, also a great sense of entitlement, which will keep you pushing on. And you feel you are different, that you feel that you should be treated differently. I mean, this goes back to that old story which your parents might have told you about, how apocryphal story, but it's an interesting story, where apparently Prime Minister Bakshi Ghulam Mohammad was asked by Nehru how many people would vote for him. So he says 40 lakhs in the valley. So he says, how many will vote for Sheikh Abdullah? He says 40 lakhs. He says, how many anti-India? He says, 40 lakhs. He says, what is the whole population of Jammu of the valley? He says, 40 lakhs. It all depends on the way things swing and which way the wind is blowing. Now, that's, of course, a cynical explanation, but I think it's not unique for Jammu and Kashmir, as in any other conflict situation, for people to have almost the schizophrenic responses to the political situation. You will... when I was an advisor, you would have the same person who was a hardline separatist, anti-India, come to me and ask for a transfer of his brother-in-law as a teacher. Now, does that mean that he's accepted the system? Does that mean that he's accepted the fact that 370 is no longer going to be an issue? No. But he also realizes that in this day, in this age, in this life, he has to use every opportunity to make a difference to his own life or to the life of the people he represents.
Interesting. And I do remember that story. I have also heard it from my parents. Let's come to the principal characters in this entire, electoral process that just took place, the political parties. Now, everybody seems to be claiming it as their victory. Let's start with the BJP. What do you think this victory at the district level, per se, if one were to call it that, what does it mean for them? And do you think as much should be made about the three seats that they have won in the valley?
I mean, what it means for the BJP is that they, Jammu, or parts of Hindu Jammu, let's call a spade, which is a Kathua, Jammu, Samba, Udhampur, are overwhelmingly still bastions of BJP's support. It also means that they have made a slight foray into Kashmir. Now, three is not a huge number, but that the BJP, which was seen as almost untouchable even a few years ago, has been able to get the votes that it has in the valley, does suggest that they are incrementally making a difference. Of course, finally, they have got the largest number of votes. That's also because the people in Jammu voted in a greater number than in Kashmir. But having said that, and also not to take credit away from them, their polling numbers are almost equal to, or slightly less than perhaps, than the Gupkar Alliance all put together. Now, that's a significant number, that if BJP scores 4 lakhs or whatever number, and yet the rest of the alliance put together scores less than that, it means that their capacity to attract and mobilize people to vote for them is still very great. But it's not a sweep for the BJP. They haven't been able to make the difference despite the presence of Anurag Thakur or Shahnawaz Hussain and Smriti Irani ji and all other bigos who came from Delhi and campaigned for the BJP within the valley and in Jammu. And yet they have slowly made a slight foray into the valley of Kashmir at a time when Jansang, RSS, and BJP were often seen, as I said, political parties that you wouldn't touch. They have started to make a difference.
Interesting. Now, let me come to the Farooq Abdullah-led national conference. Honestly, the best showing. At this point, do you think that they really needed to go with the alliance, the political alliance of the Gupkar Declaration? Do you think now Mr. Farooq Abdullah, Mr. Umar Abdullah and the others within his party are thinking, oh, we've done so well, we really didn't need this alliance? Because it has been a great showing for them.
Yes, the only question that you'll ask yourself if I was in Farooq Abdullah's position or Umar Abdullah's position is, so what? How does it really make a difference that they will be able to control district development council? Hmm. The political messaging of the whole mainstream of the valley coming together is much bigger, has much greater appeal, and can be amplified both locally, nationally, and internationally much more than the fact that National Conference is the largest single political organization in Kashmir particularly. Look, the fact is that within the mainstream, there was no question. National Conference is still perhaps the only political party which has a cadre, which goes down to the grassroots, which has a legacy which goes back to Sheikh Abdullah. And even today, it's become a cliche to say, oh, Sheikh Abdullah's grave has to be guarded. But Sheikh Abdullah actually empowered the grassroots through his Land for Tiller Act. And that is still a source of tremendous support for the National Conference. The National Conference, Farooq Saab and Umar Saab would, if I were in their position, I'd say, okay, going it alone might have demonstrated strength on our own. But the larger political coalition coming together sends a much larger message, or much stronger message, in terms of the mainstream's resentment or opposition to the decisions taken in August 2019.
And what about Mehbooba Mufti? and her party. Honestly, the worst showing in these elections. Do you think it's because people have still not forgotten the fact that the PDP aligned with the BJP?
I think the PDP did better. After all, South Kashmir, they did better than most would have expected. And yes, I guess there is still a feeling that the alliance with the BJP contributed to the BJP's presence in Jammu and Kashmir today. But if you look back at history, that's not really true. The BJP in those 2014 elections had swept Jammu largely on the back of a Modi wave. So in some ways, Mufti Saab's decision to actually have an alliance with the BJP was a pragmatic, prudent way of bringing Jammu and Kashmir together, and a feeling that through that alliance, the BJP's agenda on 370 and other issues could be tempered. That Mufti Saab passed away, that the alliance collapsed, and the rest, of course, is history. But I think the PDP didn't do as badly. I mean, I think Tarigami Saab should be happy that the CPM got 5 seats. Traditionally, he, in terms of the assembly, it's been a single person who's represented the Kulgam in the assembly. They got 5 seats.
Right.
So, in fact, the losers were the, if you were to ask me, the real losers were the Congress, which couldn't quite make up its mind whether it should go with its heart, which was clearly with the Gupkar alliance, or its head, which suggested that they might lose out nationally if they aligned themselves with the Gupkar alliance. Ultimately, I think because of that confusion, they have done poorly, not as poorly as many had expected them to, but still poorly. And Apni Party, which got squeezed between the Gupkar alliance and the BJP, if the Gupkar alliance had decided to boycott the elections, then I think the Apni Party of Altaf Bukhari Saab might have done much better. But under these circumstances, I think they lost out, except in Srinagar.
And
I think Srinagar itself was a good showing for the Apni Party.
For the Apni Party. No, what you say about the Congress Party perhaps is true for them across the country. They seem to be constantly juggling between the heart and the head and getting the wrong decision each time. But you talk about the political alliance of the Gupkar declaration, or the Gupkar alliance, as one would call it. Do you see any kind of fault lines appearing, or has the District Development Council election told them that this is the way to fight the might of the BJP by staying together?
The fault lines are always going to be there. The fault lines were there even in these elections. I understand there were a number of places where there were proxy candidates from the other various parties which fought elections. And there were obviously a great struggle to try and arrive at a consensus about who should contest from where. After all, these are parties which have fought against each other, whose main adversary has been the other party. And PDP's raison d'etre was the National Congress. Mufti Saab fought against Sheikh Abdullah and Farooq Abdullah all his life. So to assume that somehow fault lines will disappear, ideological, personal, political, they will remain. However, I think they see and recognize that their existence, political existence, survival, and in some ways their future is dependent on the manner in which they can temper those fault lines, marginalize those fault lines, and come together, because otherwise they could just collapse under this juggernaut of the center's policies and the BJP's politics.
Mr. Bhattu, finally, what happens in terms of the huge reservations and anger that exists in Jammu and Kashmir against the abrogation of Article 370? Where do you see that heading? Do you think that the political alliance of the Gupkar Declaration, or the Gupkar Alliance, just keeps talking about it, but it, in essence, it's just a pipe dream, and they need to assuage the people of the Union Territory, so they keep mentioning it. But in their own heads, they think that statehood is perhaps the only next step that is likely to happen.
I, Mahru, can't go into their head, but I'd say that, and you can answer this much better than I am, given that you are in Mumbai and you understand Delhi in some ways much better than I do, is that given the way this present government works, I can't see them going back on 370 or 35A. I can't even see a new coalition were it to appear in the next 5 years through the Congress, turning the clock back. In any case, so many laws have passed in terms of land laws, in terms of who's entitled to be a permanent resident, etc., resident rules, that will be extremely difficult to go back to where we were before 370 was abrogated. So frankly, pragmatically, prudently, 370 is really, I think, history. Statehood is something that I think should be campaigned for, and there should be an early restoration. And if the Prime Minister and the Home Minister want to reach out to the people of Jammu and Kashmir, now is an opportunity to actually do so. Will the resentment against those decisions of abrogating 370 and 35A go away? No. I mean, as you said, it will take time for those to heal, because after all, it's too early still. But the very fact that you didn't have separatism voice itself with the same kind of vehemence that they have done in the past suggests that perhaps that healing may have started in some ways, and this beginning of the Gukwar alliance may be more about the future than the past. But these are really speculations which you can only, I mean, I wish I had a crystal ball, but then people have been trying to predict what's going to happen in Kashmir for the last 75 years nearly, and wrong. So I'll not be the first.
Mr. Mattu, thank you so much for your insights. Lovely talking to you, and thank you for being on The Note.
Thank you, Maru. Always a pleasure.
If you like this podcast, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can listen to us on the IVM Podcast app or ivmpodcast.com. You can also follow us on our social media. We are @IVM Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. And if you want to reach out to me, I'm Mahrukh Inayat on Twitter and Mahrukh Inayat on Instagram as well.